Hey guys, Brian with the Kick Some Class podcast, the show designed around you, the educator, and helping you kick some class. Whether you are a brand new educator just trying to figure it out, or an old grizzled veteran trying not to burn out, we have the tips, the tricks, the tutorials, and the conversations like this one that are designed to help you kick some class in school, at home, and in life. And so today, I have a special guest I'm going to bring on in just a minute. Her name is Carrie McDonald, and she holds a master's in education policy from Harvard University. She is a senior education fellow at FEE, a contributor to multiple publications like the Wall Street Journal and Forbes magazine, and a host of her own podcast, the Liberate Ed podcast, as well as an author of the new book, Unschooled. Carrie lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts with her husband and her four kids, and I'm super excited to welcome her on. All right. So Carrie McDonald, welcome. It's really great to have you on.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Brian. Thanks for inviting me.
First off, I wanted to ask you kind of along the personal lines as I was reading through your bio that, you know, you're a parent, have four kids of your own, and looking back through from economics to education policy, and then the family, how does that all tie together? And is that like a tangent or a direct path to writing the book Unschooling?
Unschooled. Yeah, it was a direct path. I was an economics major as an undergraduate, and it was through economics that I became interested in education, specifically looking at kind of our monopoly system of government schooling and the lack of options for many families. And so that got me really interested in education innovation, in schooling alternatives, in education choice and personalization. And so that was sort of top of mind. I began taking more education classes as an undergraduate. And then my senior year of college, this was the late 1990s, I had an opportunity to do an independent research project. And I decided to do it on a homeschooling family that lived nearby. And this was a time, and we can't forget that homeschooling only became legally recognized in all 50 states by the mid-1990s. So it was still sort of a new approach to education. It certainly hadn't hit the mainstream the way we have seen it do today. At the time, in the late 1990s, it was the first time the U.S. Department of Education began tracking homeschooling numbers, and they counted 850,000. Now we have, of course, over 5 million. It was definitely the beginning of homeschooling becoming a legitimate, widespread educational option. But at the time, I was able to shadow this homeschooling family, and I just became completely captivated by this educational approach and the kind of freedom and flexibility that homeschooling offered. And at the time, I was doing a student teaching practicum in a local public elementary school, and same age students as this homeschooling family. And it was like night and day, kind of being able to see really this contrast up close between sort of institutionalized learning that, of course, I had gone through. I had gone through, you know, K-12 public schooling. It was all I knew. But then having the opportunity to kind of see this other way of learning just really rocked my world. And that was ultimately what prompted me to go to graduate school in education policy and become increasingly interested in the school choice movement and specifically education entrepreneurship and innovation to really drive changes and options for families. And then, you know, fast forward about a decade later with my own children, you know, homeschooling had always been something that I looked back fondly upon and seeing that family and, of course, through my research. So, you know, when we had our own children, it seemed like the natural, progression for us to have them learn without schooling.
Right. Yeah. It's funny because so I'm old dad, you know, I'm 47. I have a 3-year-old. And although she's a miracle and I'm glad she's here, it's put me in an awkward position. You know, here I am 24 years as a public educator and I battled with this idea of what does it say if I'm in the system and my kid isn't, you know, and so I'm very much like, and I'm jumping way ahead of a question that I had here. I don't know if you're familiar with Albert Hirschman's, exit voice and loyalty, the declining, it's like how people react to declining, I forget, he talks about governments or institutions, and he said they either leave, which mass amounts of teachers are doing, they remain loyal and struggle through, or they use their voice. And I was very much like, how do I do this as a parent, you know? And so I'm using my voice and considered exiting, you know, and I think I can help from within. And so maybe that's the question that I had for you is, how do you see some of the practices of a homeschooling, a microschooling, a pod learning, entrepreneur, PBL type school, like somebody like me that's saying, hey, I'm going to stick it out. I'm going to try to help within the school. Are there universals that can still work, you know, or is it an all or nothing, break ties and start fresh? What do you see?
Yeah, you know, I think it's really a moment of massive educational disruption that was beginning prior to 2020 and the coronavirus response and has just accelerated over the past couple of years. You know, prior to 2020, we already saw the emergence of microschools, which are sort of these home-based, one-room schoolhouse, multi-age models, that typically involve hiring external educators to come in and teach small groups of children. And that was really taking off. There were some incredibly successful and continue to be incredibly successful microschool networks across the country. I think, for example, of Prenda Learning, which is based in Arizona, but has microschools in several states. So that was already happening pre-pandemic. And then what you had was in the spring of 2020, a lot of parents for the first time were able to see up close and personal through Zoom schooling exactly what was happening in their children's classrooms. And some of them didn't like what they saw, and they began to really maybe disentangle education from schooling in a more direct way, realize that there were more education options available to them as schools across the country remained closed in the fall of 2020. More and more parents realized that they had to take matters in their own hands. So they created these pandemic pods or learning pods that worked very much like microschools. And in fact, many of which have evolved into much more established microschools over the past couple of years. We saw a doubling of the independent homeschooling rate in 2020 alone, to more than 11% of the U.S. school age population being homeschooled, according to U.S. Census Bureau data. And the largest driver of that increase came from Black homeschooling families that had a fivefold increase in the homeschooling rates in 2020 and became overrepresented in the homeschooling population compared to their representation in the overall K-12 public school population. So all of that is to say there was just this tremendous education disruption. And I think that we're continuing now to see that. We've had sort of flourishing education entrepreneurship. Microschools continue to be popular options for families. Again, these pandemic pods have become more formalized, and parents realize that they actually like having more of that freedom and flexibility for their children. So I think what we're really seeing is a robust marketplace of education options driven by parent demand and entrepreneurship responding to that demand, and also helped out by the expansion of school choice policies. We have in last year more than 24 states introduced or expanded school choice legislation that enables education funding to follow students instead of systems. So all of that, I think, is really leading to much greater options for families.
Which is, you know, is I was watching one of your past interviews on a podcast, and it was something about all the research you had done about the history of compulsory education. And I think, you know, you don't know what you don't know, or you only know what you know. I know they both sound kind of ridiculous to say like that, but if you've only had one story of what public education is, then it's hard for you to imagine what the alternatives are. And I mean, that's coming from, you know, an adult that went through compulsory education, a parent and an educator. And so, you know, I became intrigued with Acton Academies and some of these others that I think are just phenomenal in the way that they're educating families, you know, or providing that option. But I thought it was interesting, the buildup to compulsory education that you laid out in the history that shifted from family to the school, government, whatever, being the center of society. And so do you see the internet and innovation economy, the pandemic, pushing us back that direction?
Yeah, I think that's right. So in the beginning of Unschooled, I trace the history of compulsory education and compulsory schooling from the colonies and the revolutionary era to the modern times. And it's interesting that, you know, soon after the Pilgrims arrived in Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1620, a couple decades later, they passed the colony's first compulsory education law, which recognized a state interest in an educated citizenry and compelled cities and towns of a certain size to open and operate a grammar school or hire a teacher, depending on the size of that city or town. So the compulsion was on municipalities to provide education options for whatever families wanted to take advantage of those. But the compulsion was never on families to send their children to these public schools or to these teachers. And indeed, most of education occurred in the home, and families were recognized to be the ones ultimately responsible for their children's education. That all changed in 1852, when Massachusetts, again leading the way in compulsion, passed the state's first compulsory schooling law that for the first time mandated school attendance under a legal threat of force. And so at this point, you know, parents were compelled to send their children to a school. And it's important to note, and I kind of trace the history of this in the book, that a lot of the kind of origins of compulsory mass schooling in the United States came from a real anti-immigrant sentiment. There was an influx of Irish Catholic immigrants here in Massachusetts, where I'm located. The you know, population of Boston, for example, doubled between 1820 and 1840. There was just massive population demographic change, and many of these Irish Catholic immigrants challenged the dominant Anglo-Saxon Protestant culture at the time. And so there was this sort of sense that we needed to create these public schools and then force mainly these immigrants to attend these public schools that were purportedly secular, but that had, you know, the King James Bible and had Protestant teachers and texts. And so, in fact, many Irish Catholic families rebelled and they opened their own parochial schools. So you sort of saw the rise of Catholic education in the second half of the 19th century. And so, yeah, I think what we're seeing now in the 21st century is an acknowledgement that parents have maybe been sidelined too much in the education of their children. And certainly the past couple of years has made more and more parents realize that they want to be back in the driver's seat of determining the best educational setting for their children.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that I feel like, oh, it's obvious to me now, but I don't know if it would have been had I had kids at 26, 27 earlier in my career, you know? So I think that's interesting. And I'm trying, I don't want to fast forward my daughter's childhood, but I'm trying to think like, what is the world that we can't even imagine what the world's going to look like in 5 years? I mean, now they're saying 50% of human staff jobs are going to be done by robots and AI within the next 5 years. And so, you know, very much about how do you interact with AI? How do you interact with the code? And that's going to be what makes somebody marketable. You know, my daughter's three, so 15 years, 14 years from now, what world does she enter and how do I best prepare for that? I think, you know, it's awesome that you mentioned that shift back. That's what I think parents need to have that. And that kind of leads me into a question. I thought kids that went through homeschool got a GED. I'm in New York. And so they had to take state testing. They had to get that those requirements done. And so what does that look like? Do you see that shift in higher education? Because to me, I'm thinking $250,000 is not a great investment if you can do what you want sooner and be prepared at 18, 19 to enter the workforce and be competitive. I don't know if you got my question in there or not, but
well, I will just say, you know, first I will say again that homeschooling is legal in all 50 states, and most homeschoolers don't take GEDs or any kind of, you know, standardized tests in that way as part of a graduation requirement. I'm not sure what the situation is in New York. Some states do have standardized testing requirements, but typically not a high school graduation kind of state defined requirement. So, you know, so some homeschoolers will choose to go that route and take community college classes or, you know, certainly take the SATs. And now they're, you know, heavily recruited by prestigious universities who recognize their kind of stereotypical but widespread love of learning and kind of natural curiosity and critical thinking. And I think this gets to your kind of earlier point about robots sort of taking over or, you know, certainly competing, humans are competing with robots increasingly. And this is what I get to in the book as well, is that, you know, if we think about the qualities of human, what separates humans from robots, what separates human intelligence from artificial intelligence are things like creativity, curiosity, critical thinking, a drive for exploration and discovery. And yet those are often those key qualities that are stifled in conventional classrooms where often young people, you know, kids who are naturally exuberant will enter a conventional classroom in kind of their early days of schooling and learn that they must trade, you know, creativity for conformity and originality for obedience. And I think that those are it's sort of this opposite approach. And I think it harkens back to the origins of mass schooling, which was a very sort of industrial model. The American model came from the Prussian model, which valued standardization and order and compliance and obedience. And we imported that into the U.S. model. And here we are today still with that kind of dominant model. And yet it's a complete mismatch with the demands and expectations of the 21st century, where humans, in order to compete successfully with artificial intelligence, need to really cultivate those qualities of human intelligence, like, again, curiosity and creativity.
Yeah, you said highly recruited. So this is, you know, for lack of looking, new information to me. So that's what I'm curious about. You're seeing, because there's a whole continuum, right, of homeschool. At least we've seen this year that some people will choose to homeschool because they're totally abdicating their responsibility and they're just getting out from underneath that control. And then there's others who are taking control, if that makes sense. So most colleges they're looking for students with these experiences that you've seen.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what you mean by abdicating control. I mean, I think, you know, homeschooling families will tell you that the easy thing to do is to send your kid to an assigned district school. So when when families choose homeschooling, they're choosing the more challenging path because they, you know, are kind of crafting a curriculum and sure. Looking at their children's needs. But yes, if you look at, you know, most competitive colleges, for example, will now have specific pages on their website for homeschooled students, and they're often heavily recruited. The Harvard Gazette, for example, periodically showcases Harvard students who have matriculated at the university, and in fact, one of their most recent articles, profiles of their undergraduates, really indicated that those students learned in a much more kind of informal, self-directed, curiosity-driven style of learning. And that's really, I think, the key message that I try to put forth in my Unschooled book, is that homeschooling that simply replicates school at home is certainly one method of homeschooling. And it's probably what a lot of families kind of thought was homeschooling back in the spring of 2020, when they all of a sudden found themselves doing their school curriculum at home. But, you know, many homeschoolers will tell you that it's much more rewarding for both the family and the learners to kind of move beyond that model of school at home and instead embrace this kind of larger picture of education that's, again, curiosity driven, that's self-directed, that's tied to interests and passions. And that's really, in a lot of ways, the way we adults learn, right? When we want to learn something new, what do? And again, this incredible abundance of online resources around us, YouTube and all kinds of, for kids in particular, for students in particular, online free resources like Khan Academy, which is sort of the leader in online learning videos used in a lot of classrooms across the country. There's just such an abundance of options for learners today.
Yeah. Yeah. When I said their responsibility, what I what I say is I think there's a criticism among educators that some parents, oh, they're just saying they're homeschooling, but they're not doing anything. And I know those are not, that's not the clientele that we're both talking about, but certainly there's this perception that some of them might do that. I know looking at the flip side of that, which one was it? It's not Acton Academy. Yeah, it is Acton Academy with a hero's journey. It's really very much student-centered approach. You know, what are you interested in? And I can't remember who it was that was interviewed said, you only learn that which you want to learn when you want to learn it. And otherwise, you're kind of just covering things as a teacher. You know, I cover my curriculum. Well, what good is that, right? So,
I would pause and say, you know, the research on homeschoolers will show, and one, for example, one of the most recent literature reviews from the Heritage Foundation, led by Lindsay Burke, found that, you know, homeschoolers have great academic outcomes, especially compared to their conventionally schooled peers. Daniel Hamlin at the University of Oklahoma does a lot of work on homeschooling outcomes. He finds, for example, that homeschoolers have much higher rates of what he terms cultural capital than conventionally schooled children. They're more likely, in fact, twice as likely as schooled children to go to libraries, museums, historic sites, cultural events, bookstores than, students that are in school. So I think some of these stereotypes may linger about homeschooling, but homeschoolers in the 21st century are increasingly connected, academically talented, and successful.
Wow. Yeah, I know we had had this sort of brief back and forth before we decided if this interview was right for my audience. And you know, it's funny because I think my goal is to talk to educators who are burning out, and that, are you going to be loyal? Are you going to exit? Are you going to voice thing comes into play with, it's the exact same issue. If you are a parent looking to do what's best for your kid, or if you're a teacher looking to do what's best for you. And you know, most teachers fit into both of those categories, you know, they teach and they're a parent. And so I think it's a really interesting conversation if you want what's best for the kids in front of you, whoever those happen to be. Knowing your kind of diverse background and take on education from where I'm coming from, is there a question that maybe I didn't or won't get a chance to ask that you would love to answer?
Well, I think you were starting to get there with that last comment. So I'll just expand on what you were saying, is that in addition to, you know, families looking for education options beyond an assigned district school, teachers are increasingly looking for other options as well. There was, as you probably know, just a couple of weeks ago, a survey that came out with results from the National Education Association, the country's one of the country's largest teachers unions, that found that 55%, so more than half of teachers, said they expect to leave the profession sooner than they anticipated. That's on top of a Rand Corporation study from last June that found that one quarter of teachers expected to leave the profession at the end of the 2020-2021 academic year. We're seeing widespread national teacher shortages. Teachers are burnt out, and they're increasingly leaving the education sector altogether. But I do think some of these innovative education models, like microschools, like tutoring programs, the opportunity to go and create a new learning solution that can work better for families, is keeping these talented educators in the field that they love, and giving them more freedom and flexibility with higher pay, lower bureaucracy, lower burnout, you know, a much more fulfilling experience. So that gives me a lot of hope that these teachers, you know, recognize some opportunities for being education entrepreneurs. They can go build solutions, and parents are hungry for those.
Yeah, I think there's a tie here that I was reading one of your other articles, and in New York, of course, there's no voucher type system, whatever that works out to be in every state. They're a little bit different. And so it almost makes it a disparate, I don't know, you know, so if the money doesn't follow the student here in New York, for me to start a school, it's really going to impact the wealthy, or at least those that have enough resources to pay that on top of their school taxes. And I just think, like, in a state that's likes to champion the underdog. In this case, that's not what they're doing with their actual policy, you know? So I think we probably will see this accelerate in places that have more freedom, like Texas. And I was looking at North Carolina has a lot of these programs as well. I mean, do you see that as a barrier? Do you think these more blue states will turn in that direction?
Well, I mean, I do think we see much more education experimentation in states that are leaders in school choice. So I think of Arizona and Florida, for example, that kind of lead the country in school choice policies. But there's also some really great education innovation and entrepreneurship happening in states that don't have robust school choice policies. For example, I recently interviewed a woman named Jill Perez, who is a longtime teacher. She taught in New Jersey for 20 years. She's now a faculty member at a university doing student teacher training. But she, through the pandemic, realized that she didn't want her children kind of dealing with some of the coronavirus policies in the classroom. So last year, she began creating a pandemic pod that ended up getting a lot of interest in her community with other sort of like-minded families. And it was just parents sort of taking turns leading classes and doing various enrichment activities. And this year, she's turned that into a full-fledged brick-and-mortar learning center, a five-day-a-week model. She's got huge demand. She's growing. They just purchased a building. And she was able to attract a lot of teachers who wanted something different, who were fed up with some of the bureaucracy and hassles that they were encountering in the classroom. And so, there's an example of a bright blue state like New Jersey, where there's clear parent demand for education options and teachers really rising to that opportunity.
Wow. Yeah, that's really interesting. I had listened to your podcast where you interviewed the brothers that did A.School and then the medical. Yeah. And I thought, wow, if I've been saying this without maybe realizing the parallels between the idea of healthcare and education. And so that was really fascinating for those of you that are listening or watching. You know, I mentioned that on the onset that the Liberate Ed podcast, which Carrie hosts, this was just your most recent episode, I think. It was really fascinating for those teachers that are looking to get going, but not maybe willing to do all of the legal and work like that. It was really interesting. I may be calling those gentlemen myself in the short order, but thanks so much for coming on. If somebody wants to get more in touch with you, follow your work, your writing, how can they do that?
Yeah, so you can hopefully check out my new podcast, The Liberated Podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find me at the Foundation for Economic Education, fee.org/Kerry, K-E-R-R-Y. There you'll see links to all my articles, links to my social media accounts, and can go ahead and send me an email.
All right, guys, that is it for this episode of the Kick Some Class podcast. You can go get this podcast at kicksomeclass.com/podcast or wherever you subscribe to your podcast. And while you're there, make sure that you rate and review this podcast and share with somebody that you think needs a little extra help kicking some class. We'll see you guys later.